From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Crafty, Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Steve McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy. I, too, make nice games. This week, we're back to the drawing board for another Nice Thinking, where your nice host or a nice guest brings an idea into the clubhouse to workshop on air. And so, if everyone's ready, let's start. Steven, I'm going to need you to say your opening line again.
Did I say it wrong?
Don't look at the script. I want you to, from memory. No, I just had your mic turned all the way down.
Oh.
That's on me.
Oh, okay.
Oh, dear.
Okay, and action.
I'm Steven McGregor, and I make nice games.
All right, now whoever's editing that may or may not choose to do anything with
okay.
it.
Okay.
Noted.
All right, so Ludendare happened.
Sure did.
As far as we know. As far as we know. Right. Oh, yeah. I guess I was the only one who was there.
No, I mean, because neither of us really did anything.
Well, also true. Yeah. So I got sick.
Yeah.
And I started doing Ludendare. We went to get some food, and I always forget the name. There was sesame seeds in a sauce that I ate.
Tzatziki sauce.
Yes, that. I have a hard time pronouncing it.
I mean, it's a T-Z-I doubled sound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, that's got a lot of sesame seeds in it. Turns out I'm more allergic to sesame seeds than I thought I was.
Yeah.
Isn't
that something that you would have... That people who have a peanut allergy are really on the lookout for? Is that not something you've...
I've had sesame seeds in the past, but I think it was like on a hamburger or something.
Oh, okay.
And so like, you know, the bun.
Heavily processed.
So it wasn't that much. Okay. I think in the past, this time it was like a lot. And it wasn't like a deathly allergy, so I keep saying it was a mild allergy.
Right.
It was like pretty sick. But I got over it.
Well, whatever. I'm going to hunt down these losers who poisoned my friend.
They didn't know. I didn't know. Yeah. I guess it was good to know. The nice thing about this is it got my butt in the gear and I got an EpiPen finally. So.
Oh
my gosh, yeah.
Well, you've been so good at mitigation
for
so many years.
It
can feel distant, so you let it expire a long time ago.
And they're expensive.
They're very.
So I have been avoiding it. But
how long do EpiPens last? I forget.
I also forget. But
because it's like
long, but not long enough.
Yeah, exactly. It's like
a year
or something.
Yeah.
And then because I've seen people will like take their expired EpiPens and demonstrate how to use them on like fruit. So that way, as like this is now an education material because it is expired.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess that's nice.
Yeah. So, I mean, you kind of leapt right into it because it ruined your weekend.
Yeah.
But the idea was for you to help organize a local event that we put
on. Yes. And I mean, honestly, it was really chill when I was there for the 5 hours. We had it at the 2DHQ place, which is a local spot. Their plan is to like have more events and things.
Yeah, there's a gaming convention called 2DCon.
Yes.
It's very successful. It gets put on every year, and they have a permanent location that they opened.
Yes.
I think to like store things.
Yeah, honestly, that makes sense.
That does make sense.
But they're also trying to use it as an event space. Mm-hmm. And the local game dev community, we've held events there.
Yeah.
They've been a very cooperative partner because they're just like, we have a space, you can use it,
mm-hmm.
Which is nice. And so one of our board members, Eric, wanted to host an in-person version of Ludendare, which is principally an online game jam.
Yes.
And so hosted it there. And it was also kind of a test bed for Global Game Jam, which is coming up in January, which we've hosted here at Noble Robot, but it's getting a little bit too big for this space.
Yeah.
So we're sort of testing that out. I still need to actually debrief with him to see how it went. But it sounds like, at least for the time you were there, it was fairly casual.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, there weren't that many attendants, for one. So you didn't really get a test of the space. Like, the space is, you know, it's larger than Noble Robot office. I feel like we would still probably have difficulties with size.
Yeah.
Considering Global Game Jam.
Okay.
Just because like there's a lot of I don't know. It seemed like there was enough space for this jam, and also they had a board game event on Friday that they double booked, and it still was fine. But I think that like the numbers are going to be probably larger. And so I think that like it's just going to be kind of difficult
to get
everybody
50 or 60 people.
Yeah.
It starts to strain even that space.
Yeah. So, you know.
One thing also, so I worked with a hybrid team. There was someone who was attending from Rochester online, except for I think the last day, which was the only day that he was able to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that was nice about the Noble Robot space is that we were able to pop into a conference room and I set up an external microphone in the middle of our table, connected just my computer to Discord, and then had us like mute and listen in, so that way like me and my other partner at the game jam were able to talk and listen to our one person in Rochester.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we didn't have to mute and unmute, and we didn't have to have room noise pollution.
Right.
Which was nice to kind of be able to do that or reintegrate into a crowd or vice versa. And since it is something that is advertised within the community as like, hey, if you want to join as a hybrid person or from out of state,
yeah,
and having those kinds of teams, if you have one big room, it can make audio hard, which makes teamwork hard.
Right. And that's the point you're driving at, is that here at Noble Robot, we've done it for a couple of years in a row.
Mm-hmm.
We have also commandeered some neighboring spaces, mm-hmm. and sort mm-hmm. of, so it ended up being kind of distributed. Mm-hmm. So even though the office here itself can hold like 25 people or 30 people for an event,
yeah.
For a workspace, mm-hmm. it holds fewer. But we've made it work. We had something like 40 people mm-hmm. last year. But it's because we had access to empty spaces in the building that we were allowed to use,
yeah.
which is clearly less likely coming up.
But also,
and you're saying that is a specific advantage.
Yes. And also, having not seen the event space that you were in, event spaces tend to be open air and somewhat echoey.
It's not like that. It's like more of a, honestly, it's more like a gaming cafe than it is a open space kind of.
Okay, so like noise pollution, but it's not going to have, because there's a lot of people in the room, but not necessarily like also competing against the acoustics of the space.
Yeah.
That's not as bad as I thought it could be.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm imagining like game store open table things, and sure. those can be pretty big and a
sure,
little bit
sure.
not like kind of cavernous-ish.
It is sort of that, but not as big as you're thinking.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so if it were bigger, then it would have exactly the problem you're describing.
That's yeah. true. That's
so
true.
Kind of maybe,
like where we had, where the holiday party was last year would be
that's a big
for that
echoey
reason.
Space.
Yeah.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's a certain beggars can't be choosers quality to this.
Yes.
So I'm still going to kind of investigate options here at Noble Robot, because like, even though it was had to be configured in such a way, it was every year been a very successful space.
Yeah.
It's just been like by the skin of our teeth.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You got at least some impression.
Yeah, yeah, but you should definitely talk to Eric.
No, yeah. Well, I'm trying to move on the subject because
oh, yeah, sorry.
I think one of the things, you weren't sure if you were going to actually participate at all, but
yeah.
your purpose there originally was to do team forming, mm-hmm. which you've done for Global Game Jam. Mm-hmm. Did you get any chance to do any of that?
No. No, not in a bad way. It was yeah. just like people kind of just figured it out, and I was yeah. just there. In okay. case they needed it, so
and probably that was just because it was a much smaller event.
It was a smaller event.
So yeah,
people just
yeah.
kind of. I think a lot of people were just like freewheeling, giving people stuff, giving them like different things that they could do and stuff.
Yeah,
as it came up. So it was like it was. I don't know how solidified the teams were, unless they would have been in like another jam.
Yeah.
Mm. So you know.
So you were home all weekend. Were you sick the whole weekend then?
Yeah. I was just resting and making sure I wasn't like sick, but I was just
Yeah.
Just like. Beat.
And I also felt like, I wasted a day and the jam is
yeah.
so
yeah.
I was like,
and like a jam is hard on your body by default, and if you need to recover, you can't do that at a jam.
Yeah.
So you were at home at least on Sunday, like, kind of not fully sick, but like not ready to go to big things. Mm. So you probably had time to work on your minigame collection.
Right. Yeah. Yes. I did. And that's that. Star Trek worked. Star Trek.
Okay, well, I will talk about what I didn't do that weekend. Because
okay.
I was actually planning to pop in as well.
Yeah.
But I had some personal stuff. So Dale, producer on the show mm-hmm. and friend to all, she had some minor surgery over that weekend. And mm-hmm. so I'm like, well, I'll stay home and take care of her, but then maybe I can just do the jam remotely. Or a friend was going to come over to hang out and help take care of Dale. And mm-hmm. so we're like, oh, maybe we can do something together.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't happen. And I was very tired.
Yeah.
Instead, I just played Super Mario Galaxy.
Oh, nice. Okay, cool.
So that's been a lot of my last week, because the re-release of Galaxy 1 and 2. And those are the best 3D Mario games. Send your letters to...
feedback form.
Yes, nice game. Yeah. /feedback.
I mean, I love Odyssey like everyone else, but I think Galaxy is still the best 3D Mario.
Sure.
And so it was really fun to play that again. Mm-hmm. I played it when it was released again 5 years ago.
Oh, right.
But that was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people were sort of complaining about how, like, oh, they'd released again. Like, it's so, but, and they did, it wasn't a remaster. It was just a, you know, they updated textures. Mm-hmm. It does look better on Switch and Switch 2, mm-hmm. But I don't really care. But they didn't make any substantive changes or quality of life features or the kinds of things you'd sort of expect from a company when they're desperate to get people to buy a thing again. But yeah. Nintendo is not desperate to get us to buy this again.
Yeah.
They know we will. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was 5 years ago. So it's not, you know, it has been a while since I'd played it again. And I'm very, very close. I just beat the game, but I'm very close to all 120 stars.
Nice.
And then, like, I think there's, like, a Luigi mode after that. Yeah, I can't remember if that's one or two.
Both of them have that.
Both of them have that? Okay. But you kind of have to play the whole game again.
Yep.
And I'm like, yeah, my boy Luigi, I'm all for that. Maybe I'm ready to move on to Galaxy 2.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's going to be maybe an afternoon of playing before I get to that point.
Sure.
We'll
sure.
see.
Okay. Cool.
Other news before we get into my big topic is there's been some Star Trek news.
Yeah. Hype.
Yeah, so this will be old news by the time you hear this, but it was just announced a premiere date for Starfleet Academy, the next Star Trek show, which has been described as like, you know, a CW teen drama in space, which is like not my speed, but like good for Star Trek, you know what I mean? Like different things for different folks. But I'm excited for it because Holly Hunter is in it and Holly Hunter can do no wrong, has some returning people from others. So, you know, just like any new Star Trek, it's like got connections to the past, which hooks folks like me.
Yeah.
That's kind of January 27th, something like that.
Okay.
Which is pretty cool. Exciting. And one of the fun announcements they made is that Stephen Colbert is going to be like a dean of students over the intercom in episodes.
Oh.
Like, just do a voiceover role where he like announces what classes are happening.
I kind of love that.
What a great idea, you know?
It's good.
And I do like to hear, I mean, one of the fun things about the new era of Star Trek is just now that Star Trek is a little bit more in the zeitgeist, like it's interesting like how the little pop culture interactions it's having.
Yeah.
Because for many, many years before 2017, before it came back, it was just this thing everybody knew about.
Yeah.
But nobody engaged with it unless you were a really hardcore fan. And so it's just kind of nice on any dimension to be like, oh, right, it's, you know, just to hear about it in the world.
Yeah,
it's like,
sure.
That's where Star Trek belongs, is like alive and in the world.
Yeah.
Whatever, you know, whatever show is on the air, whether it's one of the cartoons or, you know, whatever audience it's for. But they also have an audio drama that's happening right now, a podcast.
Oh, fascinating.
It tells the story of Khan after the original series episode he was in, but before the movie he was in.
Okay.
Like bridging that gap.
Yeah.
And it's got some good actors in it. And I was kind of like, okay, well, I'm not that interested in this particular story.
Sure.
But also, like, audio dramas can be really hokey.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even really good ones.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
If you've ever listened to, like, a Doctor Who audio drama because you, like, miss Doctor Who, you're like, this is great. And then you're like, oh, okay. You really have to get on its level.
Yeah.
But I've been actually quite impressed with it.
Okay.
I didn't have high expectations, which is really good. So it's an interesting time for Star Trek because, like, they're producing a bunch of stuff. Strange New Worlds Season 4 is coming out next year. Season 3 just ended.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, Steven, but I think we both felt it was kind of middling.
Yeah, there was a lot of bad episodes.
Yeah. I think it was really affected by the writers and actor strikes.
Yeah, sure.
There's, like, one or two, like, banger episodes that season, but, like, it just didn't have the arc. You know, like the ending was kind of like, I think it really, they were just rushed for time ultimately. But that show's going to end after 5 seasons. Starfleet Academy has 2 on the books, but it's not announced if they're going to do any more than that because all the regime change at Paramount.
Sure.
So it might, you know, it's going to be a couple of years where all this stuff comes out.
Yeah.
But that might actually be the end of Star Trek unless new things are announced because it's been a while since a new thing has been announced.
Yeah.
So interesting time for Star Trek.
True that.
And that's the Star Trek corner of the podcast.
We did it.
I haven't talked to anybody about this since it was announced, so I'm like, I'm just getting it all out here.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. This is the place for it, I suppose.
Yeah. So, I mean, sometimes we do Star Trek news and it's brief, and sometimes we do Star Trek news and it takes a while.
Most of the time it takes a while.
Yeah.
All right, Noble Tools.
Yes, okay, so this nice thinking, I want to talk about a thing that I've been working on for years.
Yeah.
Called Noble Tools, which is my company's Noble Robot, and so you know, many of the things have that you know, name attached. But more fully, it's like Noble Tools for Unity is what you would call it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a series of plugins I want to publish on the Unity Asset Store, and these are things that I've built for various games over the years, starting all the way back in Widget Satchel.
Yeah,
a lot of these systems come from that. And one of the things you do as a developer when you work on multiple projects is you reuse a lot of your code, and enough of the code I was reusing, I genericized it, I broke it out. Because I've been working on projects with other teams, this code, I was like, this code is mine, because if other people edit it, then I have to edit it on my other projects.
Yeah.
And so I, not always how you have to do it. Sometimes you could just fork your tools, and that's totally fine.
Sure.
But I wanted to maintain these tools
for
future projects, so I needed to wall them off. So that was all just for my purposes, right? Just so I could have it. But of course, as it goes on and on, you think, well, you know what? This could be a product. And I have a number of them. I kind of want to talk about each of them a little bit.
Okay.
But I also want to talk about like what the strategy would be for selling them, what the market of the Unity Asset Store is.
Yeah.
And just kind of like talk it out a little bit.
Sure.
And talk a little bit about it as a sustainable tool for me as a developer as I'm between big projects right now.
Yeah.
Since this is a very much talking it out thing, yeah. Do you want one of us to scribe notes for you or...
No, I'm all right.
Okay.
All right. Unless you want to.
I mean, no.
Yeah, Lydia, what were you... Steven doesn't want to do that.
Well, it's just sometimes, like, I mean, that's the thing with rubber ducking and why it's good to either... I guess we are recording it, so you could just listen back to your dulcet tones.
Could do.
It's true.
But it's really... Sometimes it's nice to have someone else there because you end up having a really crystallized moment of genius and then immediately it's like, okay, what did I say?
Yeah. I have a big... Actually, that's a sort of a good transition because I have this big notes document for it. And I'll start with that, which is... And it's very incomplete, but I'm looking at it now. And for each one of these things, I have a couple of different sort of subsections, just a big Google Doc.
Okay. Already way more organized than I would be.
I've got headers and the little document tree and stuff, a little bit like that.
It's amazing.
Yeah, well,
when a Google Doc gets that big, you need the headers to jump between. Otherwise, it's just torture.
That's true.
I mean, you give me one of these little tools and I start to spend a little bit more time organizing than actually doing. So
that's my way.
For each one of them, I'm researching competitors, tools that do something similar.
Okay.
Because one of the things about building your own tools is you just honestly are often reinventing the wheel.
Yeah.
And so I want to look at other things to help me determine things like pricing, also determine like, you know, maybe what I'm making isn't as good as what's out there already.
Yeah.
So why would I bother selling it?
Yeah.
Or maybe I could sell it, but for less. Or maybe I could, you know, or maybe there's a maybe a technical gulf, but maybe there's a philosophical difference that I think, well, my approach is better, even if the tool isn't as strong.
Sure.
Now, these are all, I haven't. This is just hypothetical.
Yeah.
Looking at a lot of this so far, the ones, and I haven't done this for all the tools yet, but the ones I've looked at, I think there are, most of them are, oh, great. There are things that do something similar, but nothing in this exact way.
Okay.
So I can like charge what I think it's worth.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then there's other ones where like, okay, this is something in a similar way. And I think this one and this one are probably have more behind them or maybe bigger projects. But actually, I really think my approach is a lot better.
Yeah.
But I might be wrong about that. It might be that... the approach is quite similar, in fact, and it's just that like maybe I shouldn't be focusing as hard on this one. So I'm sort of unsure. I think what I'm going to have to do is probably buy a lot of these things.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I mean, there are sometimes what you can do is you can have look on YouTube and see people like trying them out or doing a review or using them as part of a project and getting to see them in the wild or kind of playtesting them almost. That can be helpful, but when it comes to plugins and stuff, people get super specific about their tools, and that often can sometimes just not exist.
Yeah, a lot of times when you're marketing these things, you're capturing nothing but blue ocean. Like if someone picks one, you're not going to get that person because they've already picked one.
Yeah.
Because these are not like, even if yours is better, even if you can convince someone yours is better, like these are utilities.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, this is not changing cell phones.
Yeah.
Where you could like, you know, be convinced by branding or features. It's just, you got to get something done. If it gets it done, then you're satisfied. And a lot of this just has to do with the size of the market and the type of work that it is. And the fact that your customers are probably going to go in and like hack their own. They're going to fix their own problems.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. In a way that like consumers generally aren't. At the same time, it does mean that like that early, a lot of the success of these things, from what I understand from folks I've talked to who have published tools, is marketing is just not that useful. It's good for awareness, but truthfully, if someone wants the problem solved, they'll search for that exact problem on the asset store and they will find your thing.
Yeah.
It's the weirdest thing where, like, as game developers, we're so used to discovery being the biggest problem.
Right.
But it's because we all solve the same problem.
Mm. Yeah.
I want to have some fun right now.
Yeah.
Right?
Because that's true.
You know, no one really searching for your exact game.
Yeah.
And like, oh, I didn't realize someone made exactly the game I want to play right now. Mm-hmm. It's not how it works.
Yeah.
So you need marketing to bridge that gap. But for, you know, for developer tools, someone is going to look for exactly what you want. And if they're not looking for what you want, no amount of you convincing them is going to sell it to them.
Right.
Right? You're like, hey, I've got this localization system. It'd be so great for your game that you're not doing any translations for.
Yeah. So to clarify, I think, is the Noble Tools like a whole set of things or is it separate?
Okay. So I can talk about the structure of it.
Okay.
So the way I've talked about this in previous episodes, I believe.
Yeah, here and there probably.
Yeah, here and there, because this has been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. But the structurally, each function has been broken out. So yep. I can just list them all. I have them alphabetically here. It's not in order of importance. But there's noble feats, which is my achievement framework. The idea is to write a higher level API for all the different achievement platforms.
Okay.
Right. Key to this one is that it's gonna also allow for console APIs.
Yeah.
Most of the competitors I've seen focus on Steam and GOG and a couple of the other smaller platforms on PC because those everyone has access to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I have the APIs for the console ones, I can include that as in there. Then I have Noble GIF, which is a GIF decoder and playback. I have a media player that plays GIF files. Unity does not by itself play GIF files.
No,
the image importer will just take the first frame and make it a texture,
yeah.
Which is actually kind of the best thing you should do with a GIF. GIFs are stupid. You should never use them. But I've been on two projects recently that like used them in a way in their original animated form.
Sure.
And so I had to write a decoder, and which was a fascinating thing for me. It was like dealing with like image compression, decompression.
Yeah.
That was an interesting challenge. But then the real usability stuff is the player component.
Yeah.
And creating an asset type and all that stuff. So that's what Noble GIF does. And I feel I think even though it's a use case I don't generally recommend.
Sure.
Just like make a video. But if you do need it, there are really not a lot of good tools that are the full package.
Yeah, yeah.
So I feel actually pretty good about that one if you want.
That does sound good.
This is alphabetical, but it's also the order in which I did my research. So the rest of these have less research.
Oh, okay.
I just keep thinking about this time for a client that we had to put PDFs into Unity.
Yeah.
And they insisted on it.
Oh.
And one of the things which they did
a couple times. Did you quit and burn down the building?
No, I just trauma bonded and went to therapy.
The only two options.
One of the things that they were quite fond of doing is when we say like that's not something that really can be done in Unity is they would go to the Unity store and pull up the tools and be like, look, here's a plugin you can use.
Yeah.
And then we'd be like, okay, that has a lot of other issues. Do you want to just make a Frankenstein duct tape of plugins? Because we also don't know, and there's only one, and that might be a telling sign.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh boy.
Well, unfortunately, if you're one of those clients who's like, I have all these GIFs I want to put in a Unity project, I'm going to enable you.
I trust you more than whatever that was.
Yeah.
I'll make the poor developer you're making do this a little happier.
Yeah, thank you.
So the other one's Noble Input, which is actually, it's a layer on top of Rewired.
Oh.
So folks in this community and many independent game communities who use Unity love Rewired. Mm-hmm. Rewired is a third-party asset. I think it's like $90. You pay for it once. I bought it like a decade ago.
Yeah.
it's one of the highest value for money I've ever gotten for a developer tool.
What does it do?
So it really just, it fills a hole that Unity doesn't complete. So
with respect to like inputs and things, it allows you to like, it makes implementing inputs in Unity way better.
Mapping buttons to actions is the shortest way to describe it, but also supporting many different controller schemes.
Yep.
Come with your own. Now, Unity has since developed an entirely new input API.
That's true.
That has a similar philosophy, but is still not as good as Rewired.
Yeah.
Huh.
Rewired, I would still recommend to folks using Unity. And a lot of that is momentum, right?
Like,
it's what I use, but I have looked at the newer input system, it's not as good.
Okay.
However, there are things in it, in Rewired, that are a little bit unintuitive until you totally get on its wavelength, and especially the API, which is really, really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're actually when you're configuring in the editor, because it has you can configure inputs.
Yeah.
That is a little clunky also, but way better than Unity's native stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But the API is very, very programmer forward and not designer forward.
Yeah.
In a way that like I've written code that's meant to interface with either myself or other developers that is both. That is programmer forward or is designer forward. And like that is a different dialect of code.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
And I think that Rewired's API is very programmer forward and that's fine. But when you're dealing with that kind of thing, you are thinking as a designer a lot.
Yeah.
Noble Input is just on top of that.
Okay.
Now, that's one where I'm like, that's probably a good candidate for making a free utility.
Sure.
Yeah.
The other thing I would like to add to that, so to describe it, basically, in Rewired, you can you have all these different mappings that you can enable or disable, and you have this, but it's all very you can have multiples and combine them all, and it's very powerful. But sometimes you just want to switch from like menu controls to gameplay controls.
Yeah.
But to do that with the API in Rewired, you have to disable one and enable the other for a particular class of input. And it's actually kind of complicated. So yeah. I have a series of helper functions that really boils that down to like dot enable true false.
Cool.
For a particular input for... Also for all input. So one of the things that I was actually so surprised is to turn off all input in Unity, you can disable the whole system, but then you can't pull controllers anymore.
Yeah.
So you don't know if someone's pressing a button.
Yeah.
Which is sometimes fine, but you do kind of, as a matter of principle, you want to be able to have that information available even if you're not doing anything with it. And in Rewired, you actually have to just disable all the active maps for all the different things, and then you have to remember what they were,
you have
to cache them somewhere, and then you have to load them back up when you want to enable.
Oh,
so
yeah,
if you just want to, like, in a cutscene or in a scene transition especially, for indie developers, this is one of the hard lessons a lot of indie developers don't learn until too late, which is that, you know, players will be pressing buttons all the time, even in times you don't expect them to, so you have to imagine at every moment in the life cycle of your game what is happening if someone's mashing the A button. And when you don't consider that, you don't realize how many ways your program can break. And so I did this on Widget Satchel, but and that's kind of where it came from, is I wanted to develop tools on top of Rewired to like make it easier to handle big, broad functionality for the input system.
Yeah.
That you would use a lot.
Yeah.
So I have all these animation sequences, these like tween bits of code that need to disable input, run their animation, and enable input again. Sometimes for real reasons and sometimes just for safety.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what would happen if other listeners are active, right? So I just turn them off for now because I know I'm not going to be using them. And I have that all over every code base I've ever written in Unity. And so abstracting away all that was really valuable to me. So that is how the code works. And I feel like because it's on top of another paid asset, I think it might be maybe better to... I don't know how much value it has on its own.
Yeah.
I don't know that I could convince people to buy a plugin to a plugin.
Yeah.
Even though it has genuine value.
Well, I mean, it's the same thing you're saying. I don't know that people are searching for solutions to Rewire. They're searching for answers to questions.
Yeah.
And so they're not going to like buy.
That would be also harder to market. For that reason.
Also seems though like if it is that friendly for more than one audience on a tool that is already extremely good and does solve a problem that is people who know the tool might or who are learning a very well established tool will discover. This seems like the type of thing that if they download it for free, they go, "Wow, this is actually really helpful. I wonder what else this guy has made."
That's the plan, for that. I mean, also, I've made it already, so like, if I can't find a way to sell it, I would rather give it away than just like not give it away. If I hadn't made it, I wouldn't make it to give it away.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But I think that's part of the developer life. But also that the thing you're describing of like, here's a thing that's already great, and here's a thing that makes it a little better. That's the model for Noble Engine, my game engine for Playdate.
Right.
Same idea, right? The Playdate SDK out by itself, fantastic. But for the exact same reasons, you want things to simplify, you want things to be a little easier, that's what Noble Engine's for.
Yeah.
That's an open source project, and that is one where like I gave it away because it made sense to give that away. But so the other thing with Noble Input is there's two components to it that I think I would want to change. One would really change whether I can charge for it, which is it's an abstracted API. Why can't I just have it support Rewired and the new Unity system? Right?
Yeah.
To actually make it better, make the new Unity system better. Now, I don't know the new Unity system as well.
Right.
Like, I don't know its API space. I would have to do some research for that.
Yeah.
But I think that would be kind of valuable. It's like, no matter what input system you're using, and it could be transferable across projects.
Yeah.
So you're using this one API that you understand and know, because this old project you're working on is using Rewired, but this new project is using the new Unity input system. Rather than have to relearn all of that, just use the same API that abstracts them both away.
That's good.
Right? And that's actually a really common framework for software.
Yeah.
Is to, for developer software in particular, is to say, like, you don't want to learn 7 graphics APIs? Like, that's fine. Just use, you know, Vulkan. Just like a shader language that compiles down to all of them or whatever.
Right, yeah.
So that's one thing I've been considering for that. But the other thing... And Steven, you have, imagine, a ton of time and probably have like Tetris-style dreams about this, like assigning button mappings to actions to button mappings in the Rewired UI.
Yeah.
It is great, but also phenomenally tedious.
Yes, right? Totally. Oh, my goodness.
And I've been doing a lot of work with Unity's UI framework for the editor, which is based on HTML and CSS, and I love CSS. Listeners will know. And so I thought, actually, you know what would be really nice is I actually could do a drag and drop UI oh. for this. See, that noise is,
yeah.
is and the Unity input system doesn't have that at all.
Yeah.
Like the way that Rewire does.
Yeah, yeah.
But the way Rewire does, it really is very, like, the thing about the Rewire library, to the developer's credit, and I think it's very clear the developer should get so much credit, is, like, it's huge challenging problems, but that interface has not changed in the decade I've used Rewire.
True.
Even though many things, I mean, like, a new controller will come out, yeah. within a month, the library will be updated.
Yeah.
Like, this developer is on the ball, keep maintaining this library, because it's so good, and I think because it does continue to sell well,
yeah.
that it can be maintained, but, like, it's, you know, some things are great, but they haven't been updated in 2 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you eventually have to think about, like, oh, well, it hasn't been updated in 2 years, so, like, just make this one little tweak so it works with everything else. Mm-hmm. I feel like Rewired is in no danger of that.
Yeah.
But I suspect it's been so long, I don't know if that will ever change.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
I would kind of like to have a new, with, like, outlines of all the different controller types. You pick a controller type, there's an image of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a graphic designer, so this is, like, this usability stuff is important to me.
Mm-hmm.
I've never needed that for my own projects, necessarily. Or rather, I haven't needed it so bad to do all the work required.
Yeah.
But I think that would make a great product.
Yeah.
It would also be really interesting if it could also account for a lot of the accessibility controllers that exist, like the ones that were linked in the Serious Play special episode.
Yeah.
Because, you know, those are designed to be able to map inputs to different buttons in different configurations. Like, whatever you need, you could then just, like, kind of Lego it together. That sounds like something that would work so well with it in philosophy.
To that point, one of the things about the Unity UI system is that you can do it in the editor, but you can also do it at runtime. And Rewired has a remap, a player remap utility that they ship it with. It's okay. A friend of the show and recent guest, Andy Korth, has used it for Verdant Skies.
Yeah.
He's talked about where it fails.
Okay.
But I think it gets you started if it's a feature you want to do.
Yeah.
As someone who makes PC and console games, I'm much more of the philosophy of let the system handle remapping.
Mm-hmm.
Consoles are all great at that. Steam is pretty good at that. But if it's something your game is going to do, especially if you're releasing it outside any of these platforms that where you want accessibility provided at the software level, you want some sort of like a user remapping menu or something.
Yeah.
Rewired has something that can help you build one, but it is very old, and I think it requires a lot of love from each developer making it.
Yeah.
But if I'm making essentially that for configuring different control schemes with a UI system that works at both edit time and runtime, I could just also do that.
Yeah.
Like ship an updated version of that.
Mm-hmm.
But of all of my tools, this is the one where I have more design on paper than implementation.
Sure. Yeah. Okay.
Everything else is much closer to just fully being finished.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I really like these ideas for this.
It's a cool idea.
I know, right? And I think it could, especially if it is agnostic to the input system.
Yeah.
Which, and I'm, you know, I don't know how to write a unit test. I'm not really that kind of engineer.
So are you opposed to, like, asking for help or feedback on these kinds of things?
I think more for just complexity reasons. Like, if I'm going to make something and sell it and I want some help, like, do I pay someone? Do I
in
with them? How do that seems like I've dealt with enough of that in my life on various projects as a reluctant entrepreneur. And I would just be like, I would love to just not deal at all with that. So
that's
kind of maybe the only reason.
Okay.
I think it would actually be kind of nice to partner with somebody who could help on certain of these things. But finding that person, coming up with something that's equitable for them makes sense for me because I don't know really what kind of money this sort of thing
would
make.
The reason why I bring this up is you brought up Andy, and I know that he is a person who doesn't really use controllers very much, but I imagine this kind of thing is something that would be right up his alley.
And also, Andy has shipped tools on the Unity Assets
store. Mm-hmm.
I'll give him. Andy, if you're listening, and I forget to ping you, let me know if you'd be interested.
Yeah, yeah.
We can talk about it. Anyway, so that one is just more potential than reality right now.
Sure.
A lot of it is just the helper functionality that I've already built.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is probably the biggest system that I have.
Okay.
Called Noble Local. Mm. And this is something that I developed originally for Widget Satchel because we localized that game into Japanese and Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
One of the reasons we did that was because one of the goals of Widget Satchel was to like learn all the parts of a commercial video game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so we had the Japanese translation thanks to our Japanese publisher, and I hired someone to do the Spanish localization because I wanted more than one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To sort of justify the system but also test it.
Yeah.
Especially having a alphabet-based language that uses accent marks versus a character-based language. That makes a lot of sense as two language and also direction of reading. I mean, yes. With Japanese, you could read it right to left or left to right, but it's
still
right,
Lydia, you got to dig into the show archive because I talk a lot about this in 2019-ish.
Yeah.
Like, on this program.
I'm saying you pick, for three languages, you pick
it's a good mix,
very
right?
good yeah. three languages to pick.
I totally agree. And I don't know how much foresight there was. Like, I'm thinking back, I'm like, I don't think that was a deliberate choice, but it ended up being like a really great mix of three. Very efficient.
Yeah.
And I definitely learned a lot on that. And so I developed this localization system that's based on a serialized objects.
Yeah.
Okay. So this was something that I developed in a vacuum. I didn't know what else was out there. I didn't consider buying another tool because I was actually new to Unity when I started building this.
Mm-hmm.
And then on my more recent projects, I built them up. And the two projects that I've been working on for a long time, Dream Settler and Blippo Plus, both had heavy, heavy localization requirements.
Yeah.
And that was something I was excited about because I'm like, I have built a framework. And so those have been really, really beefed up. They can have, you know, they connect with a Google Sheet. But since I've done some research on this, I realized that one, I was like, oh no, I bet there's seven tools that do this better.
Yeah.
Oh.
Because I just never, ever looked.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I was like, oh, I'm a little worried, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, Unity itself has a localization system that's relatively new that people like.
Oh, okay.
So I was like, okay, well, have I just been Sherlocked out of this, if people know that term? But as I did research, I'm like, oh, actually, there's a particular strength of my system that none of these have. One, I was actually surprised that I solved a lot of the same problems in the exact same way that Unity did for their system.
Oh,
and even used some of the same terminology.
Oh, wow.
And I felt like, it's like, oh, I'm a real developer.
Yeah.
It was kind of a fun moment.
Yeah.
But also it means that, like, surely they had a team of people on that particular feature. So, like, yeah. I should probably take another look and make sure my version of it is robust.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Including things like, you know, accessing, like, the Google API to get sheet data, which I'm like, I'm clearly maybe not doing that as probably as good as could possibly be done.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But the idea is that you don't have a live translation. You have a canonical source. And this is, from a design perspective, this is important to me.
Mm-hmm.
You have a canonical source of data. It's your Google Sheet.
Yes.
Right? And maybe perhaps there would be other sources you could draw from, but it's the only one that most people use. So, like, I'm fine with it just being that for now, especially because it is free for people.
Mm-hmm.
You have a canonical source of data. Anything that changes has to change there.
Yes.
Do not change anything in your project.
No.
And then when you're ready to update your project, you just hit a big button that just updates everything.
Nice. Uh-huh.
That's the philosophy behind Noble Local.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's not dissimilar from other systems,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but other systems do kind of want to display the information more nice. They want you to let you edit it within the thing, and I don't want you to do that to a degree that I won't let you do that.
Okay.
And so that, I think, is there's some discipline that I think I have with that.
Sure.
To sort of enforce a very opinionated workflow. On top of that, one of the things that I think sets Noble Local apart is that and this started with Widget Satchel, but it became really, really useful on Blippo Plus in particular,
mm-hmm.
is sometimes you want canonical data that is not translations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right? Sure, yeah.
Sometimes you want to associate a character with a color,
mm-hmm.
or a file name,
yeah.
or something like that,
yeah,
or a Boolean value, or just other primitives. Like in Blippo Plus, we have our spreadsheet, our canonical spreadsheet has all of the channels, all of the shows, all of the episodes. And there's hundreds of episodes.
Yeah.
Those episodes have title and description. So those two strings for that one piece of data. And so that's another way of my system, I think, separates itself, is that it treats objects, localized objects, rather than localized strings.
Mm.
So a localized string in Noble Local is a localized object, but you can have other things that are localized objects. So it has a designer-focused, opinionated workflow,
mm-hmm.
but it has a programmer-focused design system, so, mm-hmm. or a framework system. So when the developer says, my game has all these cutscenes, well, great. I have a pre-made cutscene object that can have multiple lines, that can have time codes,
mm-hmm.
that can have delay, it can have all this sort of stuff. I have these sort of various use cases that I've built out,
mm-hmm.
but you can also build your own.
Oh.
And that's part of the system, is you can extend the localized object and say, I'm going to design my spreadsheet with however many columns. Every object is going to have three rows dedicated to it instead of one row, so I can have a title and a description, essentially three dimensions of a spreadsheet.
Right, yeah.
In a roundabout way. And I'm going to define that by extending a Noble Local object,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to say that pull from this column for this data, map it to here, And you can use all the ones I've built as examples, but it's programmer friendly.
This sounds a lot like a self-updating, canonized, outside of Unity version of some of the scriptable asset tools that have been made for me as a designer.
Ah, yeah.
So because, you know, same game with the PDF one. My engineer, there was an engineer who basically was just like helping me make tools because we needed a level designer. One didn't get hired. And it's like, well, I'm here. I guess I'm learning how to do level design.
Yeah.
A lot of that relied on scriptable assets. So that way then I, who knew what was supposed to happen, where, by whom, at what point, could fill in all of that information and attach it to the correct objects.
Yeah.
And that's where I learned scriptable assets were a thing and were super flexible and very, very cool as like essentially the a la carte menu matrix of like if you pick this thing, this is what the value is for this category. It's this value. Having that be as a spreadsheet would be very, very helpful because then essentially you wouldn't have to have a designer go into Unity.
Yeah.
You could edit it outside of Unity if the designer for some reason usually has access to Unity but doesn't. And also then you don't have to make your scriptable assets custom for the project and the moment.
Right.
That sounds really useful.
Yeah, and that's the thing about it that has sort of actually made me, because that's a unique feature, that it's essentially a, you can edit multiple scriptable objects at once using a more familiar interface. One of the things that's difficult when you design scriptable objects for other people to use and access is you actually have to do a little bit of like editor scripting to make it look nice.
That's the thing that you're
building an interface as well.
I wanted to try and update a project that I did for Code Coven so that way I could add more objects prefabs with a scriptable asset to like fill in all that info. And it was the code that I would need in order to make sure that like this accepts this type of information. This is this sort of thing. The interface of the module, the modal that would pop up for it was really hard.
Yeah.
That was the part of the API that I couldn't parse when I was trying to script that out myself in Unity.
Yeah. So it requires a little bit of like setup for each type of thing.
Yeah.
But I also have like template spreadsheets, a bunch of conditional formatting that helps you out see this. But you can basically combine your localization system with your scriptable asset systems into one system.
Yeah.
And I think that's really valuable, and I'm really excited about that as like a differentiator. But then I'm like, oh, is the name wrong? It's not. It's not really a localization system. It is, but it's something else that
provides
does localization.
More to it.
Yeah.
And so I love the title Noble Local. I think that's great. I think I love, you know, I don't really, not that worried about like the marketing value because so many of these tools have the worst names you've ever heard. So like, I don't think that's a barrier necessarily.
Sure.
But I have thought like, oh, how do I explain this to people? Because like there are a bunch of localization frameworks and a lot of them are quite good. And Unity's is like, okay.
I would love templates. If you ship that, I would love like a template for like pure localization, a template for like pure, this is something you can deal with objects, and then a hybrid. Because also what I was thinking would be kind of cool for localization, in our current work, we have translations as well as a feature. And one of the things that we have to make sure that we have as part of that is you can swap images.
Yes.
So like think of it, for example, like if you're working for Coca-Cola, you need to make sure that you use the Coca-Cola logo that is in Thai if you're going to have the game in Thai.
Yeah, you can localize more than just strings. And that is something that most localization systems do provide. That's a pretty table stakes feature.
Oh, okay.
But it is something that I think a lot of developers don't realize that they should do until it's like a little later.
You just think about swapping languages.
Yeah.
And I think the getting access to that additional functionality that's just beyond strings is not as, I think some of them are not as, they don't present that very forward.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that this tool highlights, I think I'm trying, like all of these tools need all of these things.
Yeah.
But some of these tools are really like great showcases for these particular needs. This one in particular, like you're saying, templates, documentation, instructions. Because I think as an indie developer, a lot of times you become experts on these things from zero. Like you know literally nothing.
Yeah.
And from doing it, you now know everything about it.
Yep.
And I feel like that is kind of the audience I want to target. It's like someone who like, I don't want to throw at them like terms and philosophies and structures and ideas that they should know first.
Yeah.
I want to assume they're coming to it because they've never done anything like this before.
Yeah.
And so I want to provide a great onboarding experience not just a good usability experience once they know how it works, mm-hmm. but introduce the concepts, why you want to do it this way.
Yeah.
What's interesting about this? Like, you know, what's valuable? Why you'd want to sort it this way or not or that way? Because all these tools have lots of power for people to use them a lot or a little, or efficiently or inefficiently.
Yeah. Yeah.
So sort of, again, having sort of opinionated structures on that, I think would be very helpful. And then people, you know, can do whatever they want going forward once they sort of know how it works.
Yeah.
But it's so frustrating to be given, like, to start and be like, these are the 7 ways you could do it based on this thing that you'd have no framework of design for you.
Yeah.
And so it kind of just like every step, it's like, now if you're doing it this way, do it this. And you're just like, you can't keep it all in your head.
No. Yep.
So like kind of just having a way that the system is designed to work and then introduce the complexity as you go.
Yeah.
That's a very game design thing. Mm-hmm. Right. So I feel like kind of, I think a lot of tool developers are also game designers either as well or on their way to. And so I don't think this is like an uncommon approach for people. But I do think that a lot of tools, and this is very true in open source in particular, are just so hard to learn, like aggressively hard to learn, mm-hmm. because that is harder work than making these things, is making them like usable.
Easier to use, yeah.
I feel like for your name, maybe a verb specifically for... to encapsulate what the spreadsheet to Unity link does for you or could do. The only word that can come to mind is swap. Because like that is the idea of like you're hot swapping one language to another, you're hot swapping one image for another, you're hot swapping one variable for another.
Yeah.
From this source of truth. That's kind of where I think like a noble verb, whatever be, it is evoking power beyond localization, but if you heard someone say, here's this great localization tool, it's called Noble whatever, you'd be like, oh yeah, cool, that makes sense for a localization name.
I think I've identified that like it might not be the best thing, but I'm actually not particularly interested in solving that problem right now.
Oh, okay.
It's something I'm going to have to think about again later, I think, and kind of give that some serious thought. Like, is this actually the wrong title? Right now, I'm just like, is it? I don't want to think about it yet.
Yeah, that's fair. But when you do, I think consider verbs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good idea.
So all right.
Then how do we find out what the nameless masses like and dislike about our podcast?
Oh, that is an excellent question.
Because
first,
how are we
nameless masses?
Our listeners, I guess. Yeah, you can go to nicegames.club/feedback. Let us know what we're doing wrong. Specifically me, because there's a whole section about it.
Did you like that part where Lydia just called you a nameless mass? Although, mass, it's flattering.
Yeah,
you know, true. part of a big unstoppable group.
Mm-hmm, a big unstoppable group that can give us feedback at nicegames.club/feedback.
You know, I'm sorry, I was just totally, completely consumed by this. We don't actually, there's no name for like Nice Games Club fans.
Yeah, that's what I was saying is I'm not.
They're nameless. They are a nameless mass.
Yeah, you can self-determine.
You're really
how
something.
You wish to be known.
Yeah.
Because we're down with that.
Yeah.
And you can tell us at nicegames.club/feedback.
Yeah, that's a good point. Give us all of this feedback.
Okay, so next one on my list is Noble Menu. So this is really simple. This is actually something I made for a game jam.
okay.
When the when Unity's CSS-based UI elements first created, this was years ago now, I thought, oh, I want to learn that system and use the CSS. I love CSS. Mm-hmm. And so I developed a simple just drag and drop like menu system. And it's actually not part of any of the tools I've used for any of my projects.
Oh, okay.
For UI, in-game UI, I'm still pretty, even though I love CSS, I'm actually still pretty happy with Unity UI, which is, these things are all identically named, but that is what the game object-based rect component, rect transform kind of canvas style system. I really quite like that system, but I also am a fan of the newer system, particularly for editor content. Mm. But I did make this runtime UI elements thing where you can just say, this menu has 5 elements, and just in the inspector, you add different elements. You also attach a function to what happens when you press them. You give it an icon, a font, just really very simple menu builder.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, I could love to drag this out and then release that as a free tool. Mm-hmm. It's currently available on Itch. You can get it now.
Oh.
Because I released it.
Exciting.
But it's also, it used a lot of beta stuff back, so I don't know how well it works in a modern, it was made in Unity 2019.
Yeah.
So it's been years now since I've tested that. But I feel like I'd love to give that a little bit of a polish. It was very handy. I think it's especially handy for game jams.
Sure.
Where you just like, I'm not going to design every single pixel of this experience.
Yeah,
I just
want
to pick a font and assign how many objects and put it on the screen somewhere. That's one that I think like I kind of want to drag out. But part of it is like, how many of these tools do I need? The next one is Noble PDV. So this is like a Noble GIF.
Okay.
So instead of GIFs, it's Playdate video files.
Oh.
Oh.
Okay.
For Blippo Plus.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're watching the color footage, mm-hmm. you know, congratulations, full color, enjoy yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But if you press a button on the controller, it toggles over to the one-bit, black and white, no gradient in between, mm-hmm. fewer colors than a Game Boy, video content. PDV is a format developed by one of the engineers at Panic.
Yeah.
For a lossless one-bit video
mm-hmm.
that Blippo uses on Playdate. Actually, Blippo technically uses a newer format because it's streaming video, but that's neither here nor there. So when I was developing Blippo, I was like, oh, I'd love to be able to toggle back and forth with the Playdate footage. That would be a really fun little feature.
Mm-hmm.
We called it low data mode as an, you know, it's sort of a nod to, you know, a computer systems and like the limited bandwidth of older frameworks.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's one-bit video, no compression algorithm, no video compression algorithm could take that content and display it as like an MP4
yeah.
in a way that didn't look like hot garbage.
Mm.
Even though the resolution was much lower, you'd have these enormous files that would be very lightly compressed in order to show, and it would still look bad.
Yeah.
And it would just, smears and grays and just, it would be terrible.
Yeah.
There's also no way to limit the color palette of a H.264 video.
Hmm.
You just limit what colors are in it, and then its compression will decide where to, you know, do in between. So if you give it something that's pure black and pure white, you will end up with some greens in there, probably.
Oh.
Weirdly. You know, these codecs are, like, some of the greatest miracles of modern engineering, mm-hmm. right? I have a lot of great things to say about them, but in this particular use case, it was in no way usable for us.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So what I needed to do is I needed to decode the PDV format, write a decoder. And I had already done this with GIFs recently.
Right.
So I was like, oh, okay. And it's very similar. And somebody had done a little bit of the work already and posted a sort of a reverse engineering thing.
Ah.
Also, I had direct access to the person who created this format.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
But I ended up not really talking with them that much about it because I was able to get there without his help. I'm a little proud of that. Now, his newer format, I have not even looked at. So we'll see. I probably need his help if I
need to update it. Yeah.
But the PDV format, it's used in very little things right now. Some games use it for cutscenes. Blippo was going to use it to stream video, but it required a different, more modern format that that Dave made. But the PDV format was everything I needed. And so all of our video content was available in that format. And so I wrote a decoder and a media player for it. And it's black and white, but great. You can just give it two colors.
Mm-hmm.
So you can assign. So it has lots of functionality.
Yeah.
Who's going to use this? I have no idea. But what's interesting is it could give extra life to the format because it's visually very interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of like pixel art games that would be like, that would be a great way to do video.
Mm-hmm.
Is it has better compression rates than GIF. I guess it could support multiple colors if we wanted to, you know, if I wanted to get further into it.
Sure.
But all it does now is just playback Playdate video files.
Yeah.
So it has an extremely limited market. But that market includes a lot of people who are actually porting Playdate games right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Ratcheteer is coming to Steam. There's a couple other high-profile Playdate games. Now, with Blippo, we just rebuilt it from scratch.
Yeah.
Mm.
But there are other games that are making PC versions, either just a straight, so it just looks like it did, or like a full color version. So I don't know who would buy this thing.
Yeah, okay.
So it might also be something that's just worth giving away because it's a bit of a novelty. But I'm very proud of it as a library. Like it's something that makes Blippo possible, and it was something that I do think of myself as a reluctant engineer. And so I'm a designer, I'm a graphic artist, I also am a programmer, I have a lot of experience, I'm very good at it, but I don't consider myself, like, I don't think of my engineering accomplishments.
Sure.
But this was one I was very proud of.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I built that in its own library because it needed different components, and I was already sort of working in that framework. So it just was like, rather than just build it directly into the project, it just naturally I built it as a library.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay, maybe other people could use this. I don't know.
Yeah.
So that's a weird one. But I think it also kind of, as a part of a collection, mm-hmm. I think it's kind of has an interesting, it kind of says a little bit about like the range as a bundle.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Kind of like what you can do with all these tools.
That's what initially started this.
Yeah.
I had asked you if this was going to be like a bundle of things or just like individual things.
Yeah. So you can both.
Okay,
so,
both. Okay.
So the Unity Asset Store, it didn't used to be as good at this, but I've researched it again recently. Mm-hmm. You can sell things individually, and you can also sell them as a bundle.
Okay.
And the structure of that I will get into.
Sure, got it.
So then I have Noble Rumble, which is just an abstracted API for Rumble stuff. Again,
that is nice to have.
With controller API stuff. I didn't use that on Blippo.
Oh,
because I ran out of time to implement any kind of feedback in controllers.
Yeah, okay.
Now it's a TV watching experience, so like I think authentically your controller doesn't have Rumble.
Yeah.
But it would have been nice to do.
Sure.
And in Dream Sether we didn't get to that point yet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The last real work I did on that was for Widget Satchel.
Okay.
But that was a way to take the Nintendo Switch's linear actuators and the Xbox style Rumble and the PlayStation, and because I think you had this experience on Fingence, is that different controllers, when you give them the same value of just the generic Rumble API,
yeah, it would get pretty
it
dramatic.
Doesn't give an equal experience.
Yep.
So that library really even things out for me.
That's
and
nice.
Because the Switch, the way it works, and the PlayStation 5 controller works this way now too, with these linear actuators, they're essentially speakers.
Yeah,
and so you can feed them what is essentially audio files.
Yep.
You can feed them literal audio files, but also you can create. Nintendo has this interesting utility where you can like actually create the format that's not just strictly audio files, but you can work in an audio editor to make your vibration patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And so I basically developed a system for using both of those things with just a sort of an abstracted API. So I'm happy with that, but it's been a long time since I've touched that.
Yeah.
But that belongs in a collection like this. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where I have to do a little bit of work. And then Noble Splash is just a splash screen. It's very
okay.
like Noble Menu, where it's just like if you need a splash screen with a developer logo and tools logos, it's a separate scene. It also does preloading.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have like a first load scene, but you it's like, oh wait, how do I load that first? It's the first scene. I was like, all right, just load up Noble Splash. It has its own scene. Tell it what scene it is. Tell it what asset bundles you need to preload. Tell it with that, and then it has a great stepped function where it like. It will just check, has this been loaded yet? Has this been loaded yet? And it will not proceed until everything's loaded.
Oh, nice.
Depending on what you give it. So now I think a lot of people will roll their own experience of a splash screen.
Yeah.
And this wouldn't be for them.
Okay.
But it is a very plug-and-play system that I developed. Even on Blippo, I ended up modifying it a lot for our particular needs.
Okay.
But it is, I think for a lot of indie developers, I think it's just like it gets the job done. And especially that preloading stuff.
Yeah.
Has like a loading whirly gig. It does all the things for you. You give it an animation. You can give it a GIF if you want, if you have Noble GIF installed. And it has a logic to it. Now, if you only are loading a scene, you just tell it a scene, does that.
Yeah.
If you are only loading assets and you want to do scene loading later, you can do that. Whatever it is you need to load. You can also give it a specific function callback. So you can say, load all this stuff, but also wait for this particular callback.
Mm.
So you can make it your own in that sense. And then you provide it with developer logos and copyright information, and it lays it out automatically for you. That's the part where you'll probably be like, all right, I'm going to tweak it what I want, unless you just want to use it as is. That's kind of fun. And then the last one is like probably the one that showcases best the abstracting different platforms, which is Noble Save. This is my save and serialization system. We talked about this a little bit with Joanna when she was on the show a while ago. Because she has built a serialization system in C# that she uses for Godot.
Mm.
And I built a save system for Unity.
Yeah.
And actually, we've talked since. And because I think in that, I was like, oh, I would love to crib from your work for my system. And she was like, great. But we've talked since, and it's actually, we actually tackled different parts of the problem. So I'm actually kind of, I think they might go together really well.
Ooh.
Now, I handle serialization in a couple of different ways currently.
Yeah, okay.
One of the things I've talked about on the show before, but in C#, there is the binary formatter.
Yep.
You can take any data, turn it into a blob, and then you've got a file you can do whatever you want with.
Yeah.
That API is going to be depreciated. It has security implications.
Right.
Now, for games, who cares? But, like, eventually, Unity will update to a version of C# that no longer allows you to use this API.
Yeah.
So there are other ways to serialize data. Most people use JSON. They take all their data and they turn it into just a big string that is 10% quotation marks.
Yeah.
Which I just have, like, I've complained about on the show before, but I just hate that so much. Mm-hmm. I know it's good. I know it solves all your problems. I just hate it.
Sure.
Like, I'm not
cosmically.
Yeah, basically. Now, I'm not advocating you use XML or anything like that, but yeah. I think a binary serialization, I think, is an important use case that I think people are ready to just be like, oh, we'll just save it as a string, and it's great, and it solves all our problems. Mm-hmm. And that's true. So I want this my save system, which is the abstracted API, to plug into any serialization system you want. Mm-hmm. You can do JSON or XML or binary formatter if you really want to use it. Or what I use currently is a thing called Protobuf, which is a binary serializer that gets around all the security implications. It is very difficult to use.
Oh.
And so I've abstracted a lot of that.
Okay.
It also means you can't use ahead of time compilation.
Ah.
People who know that it means you can't use the IL2 CPP scripting backend on PC, which is fine for a lot of games, but I think I would recommend you use that where you can.
Yeah.
It's what consoles and iOS uses.
Right.
So having a consistency there is good. Mm-hmm. Used to be that you'd have actual functionality differences between the two scripting backends in Unity. It's not really true anymore. You can use either, and you pretty much have the same experience as a developer. Mm-hmm. And as a user, there's some speed benefits, but not a lot.
Yeah.
So the current mono is great, but it is kind of on its way out, and compiling to IL2CP is I think, the better option.
Yeah.
Now, Joanna has a system that gets around that.
Ah.
That's where her serialization system, and that's kind of an important part of working with consoles and iOS, where I just use the binary formatter because it was still available, and the security implications are way less on those platforms.
Sure.
It's like, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's not complete because of that.
Right, okay.
But the benefit of this system is you just tell it to save to disk. Here's the name of the thing. Here's the type of data I want to save. So it has sort of an extendable class where you can say, this is what my save data looks like. It has things like a time stamping. For Widget Satchel in particular, we did checkpoints. Mm-hmm. So when you have a saved data, you have all the checkpoints along the way. Your save data includes copies of itself at those checkpoints.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was something I built for Widget Satchel, and I haven't used it on any other project, but it's part of the system.
Yeah.
And so all that under the hood works for this the sort of data types you create. And so the highest level stuff, I'm really, really proud of how it works. It's the lowest level stuff where once it forks the different platform you're on, it will choose the correct serialization strategy for each unless you tell it to use a specific one. And so the real challenge is getting ahead of time compilation working with binary serialization on desktop platforms.
Okay.
And that is probably the biggest work I need to do for there. But I think that Noble Local and Noble Save are my two biggest systems.
Sure.
And I think they're both also the two systems that have the most competitors.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think they both have very friendly APIs, and I'm very proud of them. And so I think those are the ones that would cost the most sold separately. But I think one of the things that is I want to focus on is that designer forward experience. Like,
yeah.
If you want to do this particular thing, here's how you do it in this tool. I think a lot of times the tools are, if you want to handle this data and store it in a particular way, but a designer looks in that and goes, why would I want to do it in that way?
Yeah.
And it's like, now you can come to that, and someone who is a designer engineer, you can bridge those two things. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, I know, as a designer, I know I want to do that, but I only know that because I can map out what it means from an engineering perspective.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think I want a lot of my tools to be like, you're a game maker.
Mm-hmm.
You got roped into writing code, mm-hmm. you know,
yep.
Apologies. And you do so much of it, but you're what you want to do is make games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you think like a designer, you think like a sort of a, you know, indie developer.
Yeah.
And so I want to focus on that perspective first without hiding any of the complexity.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to, particularly with like Noble Local, like, its workflow invites you to create your own classes that extend on it,
yeah.
and teaches the API and is very programmer forward. And I don't want to hide that from you.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't want to give you that first and require you to understand that before you can even get started or
yeah.
understand the value of these systems. So all of them are like that. So the reason why this sort of connects is because, like you say, what would this give me? Will it give me this? And I think it should be very clear that what it will and won't do,
yeah.
From its descriptions and how it's described, to give you understand it so that you can make a real decision as to whether you want to use it or not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because sometimes, a lot of times you'll look for a plugin and you'll be like, you know, it turns out after researching all these plugins, I actually only need a tenth of what any of them offer,
yeah.
and I could build that in an hour.
Yep.
And that's a good use of your time, is that kind of research.
Yeah, for sure.
But you wouldn't have known that unless you got all these descriptions of how these systems work,
yeah.
that you didn't know before. And so, you know, as a minor service, that's a lovely thing to contribute to.
Yeah.
Understanding of why they may or may not want to use these systems.
That's true, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're hitting an hour now. I'll talk a little bit about the structure.
Okay.
And then we can kind of, you know, I can get as much of your advice as you can squeeze at the end of the program.
Sure.
But it's been good to sort of describe these things.
Yeah, I think that's helpful to process what you've been thinking through and actually say it to other people, and you can hear my reaction to
tools,
I guess.
Well, I'm also just really, I'm getting a better idea of how they relate to each other and what the size of it is, because a big part of it is I do want to sell them as a bundle, because they do work with each other.
Okay.
Now, structurally, it's actually quite complicated to get them to work with each other. You have to use compiler conditionals, like if this is installed and work with this. Noble GIF is interesting because you can also interact with Noble Save. Noble Splash will also interact with Noble Save. Like, do you want to load your save file before the splash screen?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what save system you're using, but if you're using mine, you can add that to the logic.
Yeah.
If you don't have that installed, I don't want that code to reach a dead end.
Yeah.
So I'm using assembly definitions across all these things. So they're all the code is contained. That's helpful when developing, because then I realize, like, oh, why can't I access this code? Oh, right, because it lives inside this library. I need to import that. And so that's been pretty good. I'm a proponent of that way of structuring your code, even if you're not using libraries. It's sort of nice to break up things that way. But because all these tools, as I develop them, I have to be very careful not to have them dependent on each other.
Right.
But I don't want to prevent them from working with each other.
Yeah, because you want everybody to buy a multiple of these things.
Yeah.
Even if they don't get the whole bundle.
Yeah, well, I mean, I just want them to work better.
Oh, sure.
Because, I mean, the use cases I developed for them were sort of in concert. So, I'm not going to just wall them off just so I can sell them separately.
Yeah, yeah.
They need to work together when they can work together. And so the way it works is you download any one of them. It goes into a folder called Noble Robot.
Okay.
A subfolder for the library,
and
every one of them includes another folder called Common.
Okay,
and I have a bunch of utility classes, you know, very basic functionality that all of these things use that I just have in a Common folder. This is pretty. This is not unusual for tools developers who release multiple things. Is there are some helper things that all the tools need?
Yeah.
That are very small or simple,
and
that can go in a Common folder. Now, some of those are actually quite interesting on their own. And I think I might just release that as its own free download.
Oh, sure.
Because it comes free with all the ones anyway.
Yeah.
And that's a good loss leader sort of thing to introduce people. But yeah, ultimately, it's you as many as you need.
Okay.
Or buy the bundle.
Okay.
And explore what's possible.
Okay.
One of the sort of business models that I think, you know, everybody hates the Adobe subscription model.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not here to defend that. But one of the things I will laud Adobe for is bundling all their software.
Yeah.
They did this before the subscription model, and that's when I got hooked on it originally. But the idea was, is that you use this program and this program, great. Would you pay 20% more for 300% as much software?
Yeah.
And you're like, hey, I guess so. I don't know if I'd use it, but it's a good deal. And I've tried this once, and it'd be nice to own it, and it's a great deal from all the others. So I'll do that. Then, now that you have them, suddenly you start to learn them. And that is a big part of my development as a digital artist.
Yeah.
Is like having access to After Effects, even though all I wanted was Premiere and Photoshop.
Right.
Like, well, you can get that in a bundle and includes After Effects, and that's a really powerful, intimidating tool that you are not ready for and costs $1,600 by itself. But like, it's really cheap if you get it with the ones you were going to buy.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I guess I will. And then, you know, that led 10 years of me working as an animator and compositor in After Effects. Like, that's a big part of the philosophy of making this as a bundle.
Okay, got it.
Is to, like, say, like, you're not going to need all these tools necessarily. You want one or two of them.
Yeah.
So I want to price the bundle pretty aggressively so that you get a really good value for it to sort of encourage that. But also, you know, at that point, the price will be relatively high.
Sure.
So if you only need one of them, you should be able to just get that.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That makes sense to me. As a counterpoint to your Adobe thing,
yes.
I've had little inside baseball. We use Adobe Edition to edit the podcast, and I've had that for years and had the whole suite of things, and I've only touched Edition. So it works for some people, not for others.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think that this has a better pitch as a bundle because you get a bunch of tools, and I can imagine a situation where you're working on this game and you only needed like two things in the Noble bundle. Is it Noble Bundle? I don't know.
I honestly don't know.
Okay. I guess it's Noble Tools, right.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're only using two things, and then you're working on something else, and you're like, oh, man, I really need a save system. I didn't need it before. And then you realize you have that already in this package.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm assuming it wouldn't be a subscription model.
No, I mean,
I don't even think it's possible.
I don't have the infrastructure to do something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. So like that, I could see somebody like purchasing the whole thing if they need two of the things, and then they can get some benefit out of it down the line.
Yeah. And sort of, a bit obliquely to that point,
yeah.
Like one of the reasons the subscription model is something you could justify to customers is because you have ongoing support, and like that's what you pay for, right? It's not just a trick,
right?
It's like you get regular updates, you get you know, good support. That's the point of those systems.
Right.
Now, companies, you know, get that money and they're like, well, maybe I, you know, they're getting those, the money. I don't know if I have to fulfill that promise.
Yeah.
That happens.
Yes.
And so other than the sort of infrastructural ability not to do that,
right.
I want to release these and I make games. I don't know when I'll have time to do
Sure.
Or even to fix bugs.
Yeah.
And so I have to be like, this is what it costs. This is what you pay for. If it's got problems, I'll fix it.
Mm-hmm.
But like, if you need a new feature,
that'll come later. Maybe
it's like, I'm not promising any roadmap on that because my timeline for working on this project is I want to get a number of these finished and ready to go. I think because I want to release them fairly quickly,
mm-hmm.
I am probably not going to release all of them.
Oh, okay.
I might just do a couple of them and then actually just save the bundle for when they're all ready or come up with a smaller price bundle or do something.
I actually think that having smaller bundles based on use case or problem would maybe be the happy medium between the two of you. Like, besides the mega bundle of, like, you love my tools and you work a lot and here's all the things. Like, Noble Menu, Noble Splash.
Mm-hmm. Right,
So it's the idea of, like, hi, you are making a game, and here are...
Sure.
Let me help you make, like, the bookends of that a little bit easier. You could even add Noble Save.
So in the old days, Adobe used to do something very similar. You had Photoshop Illustrator
mm-hmm.
and InDesign would come in a bundle, and then there'd be a separate web designer bundle that would come mm-hmm. with Dreamweaver and Photoshop also.
Yeah.
And then you had the video design, which, and, like, some crossed over, but it was very much, like, discipline-focused.
I think for me, that makes sense because... I may be committed to having a save system or need to have a menu system in my game, but I may not have thought about actually having a splash screen or may not have thought that I would have had the scope to figure out how to do that. And so if I am here for your menu because that's what I need, but you and I like your menu system and it came with a splash screen, then for me it's like, oh, that's actually a little bit That's actually a little bit easier for me to approach, try out to do.
Yeah, okay.
That would then be the gateway into adding more things and learning how to figure things out.
I would say I'm kind of ready to rule out anything more than like two types of SKUs, like a bundle and then the individuals. I think more than that, what you're describing is 100% correct, but not at the scale I'm at. I think the reason I want to kind of just focus on the one big bundle is one that philosophically I think it's helped me to have a big group of tools and I want to provide that to other people.
Sure.
So I think what I would rather do is if I have a couple of these tools, if I ever make a new one, for example, I would kind of just think to include it in the bundle without raising the price of the bundle. Like, I think that would be my pattern going forward. Now, how smart that is a question, but I think like I would prefer to do that than to have multiple different configurations, or as the thing gets bigger, raise the price more and more, because then it starts to become less and less attractive to anybody.
So you would always be adding the individual that is priced per individual, but then you would be adding it as well to the bundle and keep the bundle price the same?
I think so.
Kind of like albums and songs?
Yeah. And that's how Adobe has done it, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when they do price increases, that's separate. But like when they develop a new piece of software, they do just give it to you for free.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and part of that, it increases the value of the product. Right?
Yeah.
And so, and it also... not for nothing, is just simpler, like logistically simpler. And I think, you know, as someone who's doing a bunch of other things, like, I'm willing to have a suboptimal, like, business model if it's 10 times simpler for me.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
It does.
Yeah. So it's a big thing, and I don't need to make it a big thing. Like, I could just package all this stuff up, make sure it works okay, and, like, within 3 days, put it up for sale. But I don't have that temperament. I need to, like, get nice logos and do good store copy, and I really have to. The question is can I get it done by Christmas? That's what I'm hoping on. Get something done by Christmas. I feel like, so the scope of it is actually a question I have.
I would aim to release the individual ones by Christmas and have
whatever's really finished.
Focus on the store copy for the individual ones, because it's going to be a lot harder to write store copy for a bundle that covers all of the problems and things you're solving in a way that is not overwhelming or unintelligible.
I like that.
That also means that, like, you'll then have a little bit of leeway of data in terms of, like, purchase or download when it comes to the free ones data to see what are the ones that people are really excited about or seem to be, like, a hole that you are filling or one that they are being captured by, which will then influence the copy that you write for the bundle.
Yeah, I like that a lot. That also simplifies my logistics.
Yeah.
Right? And maybe this will be something I can do once we're done today, is I can just say, like, these are the of the however many there are, mm-hmm. these are the 50% of them that I'm going to aim to finish by Christmas.
Yeah.
And then I can get those up separately, individually, and then I can work on the rest and get collect some data and then launch the bundle when I add a couple more.
True. Yeah, that's you, really good.
You also will then have a sense of how many that you've released that are free versus paid, which yes. will then give you a better sense of how much you should be charging for the bundle.
Yeah, yeah. That's I mean, pricing is something we didn't get into, but one of the things about these sorts of things is like developers are price sensitive to a degree,
mm-hmm.
but like people spend $100 for really simple things
yes.
to get the job done.
And yeah, so, yeah.
This is different from selling games.
Definitely.
In a way that like, it gives me kind of a sigh of relief. Like yeah. I can just price what these things are worth. I
yeah.
don't need to price for volume. I can just say I need to like what that is going to be really dependent on what other things price and how I can do it. But also people talk themselves into like, oh, this has this. This one's a little better and it's $20 cheaper. But this one I like the store copy better and and it's been more updated more recently. I'll mm-hmm. spend more money yep. even if it's not a like people don't do all of the data analysis thing. Like if you just price it, what do you think it's worth? Like. I think I'll be okay. Yeah. I don't have to be so cutthroat in a
yeah.
yeah.
As a result, we also wouldn't be particularly helpful in helping you provide that price or figuring out that price.
No, that's true. Well, I'm kind of just sharing sort of my thoughts on it and also yeah. just kind of maybe giving myself into like it'll be what it is. If it's too high, I'll lower it.
Mm. Yeah. Well, because like for the individuals, you have such a clear mission of it is going to be priced what it's worth, and sometimes that means free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the there are the other variables with the bundles in terms of like how much are people willing to spend in order to get tools that they think they might need or might want to try someday or might yeah. not actually need. And that is a slipperier thing. That is like people love a deal, but the thing is also you are if you are going to continue working on the model of as you add new tools, you add it to the bundle for free, quote unquote, you want to make sure that you are still somewhat honoring the paying for what it is worth and yeah. specifically paying what your future work will be worth at some point someday.
Yeah.
And that's a lot harder to nail down.
Sure
having
is.
More time to figure that out and whether that means, you know, getting a sense of your own scope for the future
yeah.
versus like for what you want to add in the future versus what you didn't add for the first release and you wanted to get out into the store alongside what is already out there that you have put out and do feel is worth and is that accurate?
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
And, you know, the things I will make in the future will always be things I make for myself first.
Yeah.
And so in a universe in a year when this is out and I get some data, I will understand, like, if I'm making some tools for myself, I may be like, you know what, this doesn't sell, this sells okay or whatever, or maybe it sells badly. That will tell me, like, oh, is it really worth, I'll just package this up and make it nice for myself rather than make it a product because mm-hmm. I know what, it, you know, I'll just keep selling what I'm existing selling. Or I'll be like, you know what, this is worth spending another couple of weeks or a month getting this ready to go because these other tools have done well enough to justify that. And I just don't know that yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious, actually, when you sell a bundle of tools, do you get user data in terms of which tools get used?
No. I mean, you could, but like, I don't, that's complicated. And I think users, developers in particular, would be not happy for you to implement systems.
For sure.
Yeah.
There are some tools yeah. that have like their own launchers and are like sort of outside the Unity system.
Yeah.
Well, again, I don't yeah. have the, I don't really want to build something that complicated
right.
and people don't like it.
Well, I was also wondering if it's like you buy a kind of, I was almost imagining like when you buy a bundle on Steam and then you can add and install each game individually. And it's like, which ones would you, so then it's like you bought this bundle, but which games did you install?
Oh,
I don't
sure.
know
right.
if that's
no,
how it works.
It's there's that level of like user analytics is not available to you.
Okay.
In a way that is, I think, good.
Then I think, yeah, focus on the individual ones
yeah.
and then bundle later. Also, because then you'll have a sense of how big that bundle is. You
yeah.
know, is it appealing because it's five things and three of them are free, or is it only three things and is that really a bundle?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Until you make the other two and finish those up because I don't know, Christmas got busy. Whatever.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. And you know, the I want the bundle to be an enormous value, but it's mm-hmm. also going to cost a lot more than like three of the tools on their own.
Yeah.
And so I want people to buy it, you know, put a little bit of extra money on like maybe I'll use it.
Mm-hmm.
But that might mean that how much extra value you get is very attractive. It might mean that the people who are ready to make that leap is so small, even at that incredible value, that it's just an option and not many people do it.
Yeah.
I won't know that.
Yeah.
I want to provide it partly not for marketing reasons or for business reasons, but because I sort of believe in that model.
Yeah.
And so if that's all it is, that I just am able to execute on that, even if not a lot of people, you know, are convinced by it, that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a good enough reason as any.
Yeah. Well, I've actually got a bit, I mean, it was really good to talk it out, but I think I have a little bit more of like a focus on like the scope of what I want to do by Christmas.
That's great.
Now, we'll see. I mean, I'm not going to say it's that much less likely than you getting your fishing mini game. But I think it's similarly, I'm a little worried that like it's going to be mid-November and I'm going to be like, I have not made a lot of progress.
Well, the nice thing is we can ask you about that instead of asking me about the fishing minigames. So that'll be great.
Cool. So we'll have those two things to ask us about.
Yeah, right.
It's a high noon shootout and both of you are pointing guns at each other.
That's our show. For show notes and links for this and other Nice Thinkings, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. I mean, I could use the money. These things aren't for sale yet.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Discuss this episode or others or whatever with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. And please tell me which of these tools sound interesting to you.
Yeah.
And, like, maybe what you'd pay for them. Next week, we'll be looking at naming files and the 2025 Unity security vulnerability. But that's it for this week. So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.